All right. Last week, my name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris. Last week
we got started and we did the foreword and we did the doctor's opinion. We're gonna see how far we get through Bill's story today. But what we are doing is we're presenting from the original manuscript. You can find the original manuscript. I think Dave said that these are stocked in the back. This has a copy of the first edition as it was published by Alcoholics Anonymous World Service, and then it has in the back a copy of the original manuscript. You know, why we wanted to do this this workshop on the original manuscript is because basically Bill and the alcoholics put the original manuscript together. They batted it back and forth between Akron and New York, but they put the original manuscript together, and that's when Bill handed it out to the non-alcoholics for criticism. And you know, we're not going to debate whether the changes were good or bad or indifferent. That kind of doesn't matter, at least for this workshop. What does matter is, you know, we're going back to the earliest layer of tradition in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that really is the original manuscript. And there's a different voice in the original manuscript. It's basically more in your face. It's a lot less, you know, we did this, and it's a lot more, you better do this or you're going to die. It's a completely different voice in certain areas of the original manuscript. And I think it's a closer representation of what the first 100 were going through and what they were trying to say to us. So that's kind of why we're doing the original manuscript here. And hopefully some people besides Dave and I will get something out of it. All right, chapter one, Bill's story. War fever ran high in the New England town, which we knew young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. We were flattered when the first citizens took us into their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with hilarious intervals. There's a lot of different language. You know, he's saying the same thing, but if you're looking at the big book, you'll see a lot of the changes. I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudices of my people concerning drink. In time, we sailed for over there. I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. We landed in England, and I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot whether he died by musket or by pot. Ominous warning, which I failed to heed. 22, a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me special token of appreciation. My talent for leadership, I imagined, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with utmost assurance. You know, one of the exercises that I learned from one of my spiritual mentors is, you know, when my first experience with the book Alcoholics Anonymous was basically this. Man, this thing is clanky. You know, it's not very well written, and it's coming from a point of view of somebody that was in my grandfather's generation. And I'm not really getting with it. Well, an exercise that I was given by one of my spiritual mentors was this. In the first 8 pages of Bill's story, he talks about what it was like. In the second 8 pages, he talks about what happened and basically what it's like now. He talks about the recovery process. In the first 8 pages, I think it's important, and I learned this through the exercise that I was given, to highlight everything I personally relate to. What from my own experience can I relate to? Now, obviously, I'm not a veteran of the First World War, you know, but there are things that I can relate to. Like when I discovered liquor, there were moments hilarious and things that were sublime. I mean, you know, that's what alcohol meant to me. It meant freedom from loneliness. It meant freedom from fear. So, you know, I would have highlighted a bunch of stuff in these first 2 paragraphs doing that exercise. Obviously, you know, there's some things that I can't relate to that have to do with his life, but his experience and his relationship with alcohol is something I can 100% relate to. The second part of the exercise that I was given was to highlight anything I have resistance to in the second 8 pages of Bill's story. Because Bill talks precisely about what he did to recover from alcoholism in pages 9 through 16. He talks about what he did. And it's a good idea, it's a good first step exercise to highlight anything that we might have resistance to. Because he talks about going out and making amends. He talks about turning his will and his life over to the care of God. He talks about spending the rest of his life carrying the message to still sick and suffering alcoholics. If I have any resistance to that stuff, it's best dealt with back in step one. It's really a bad idea to start moving through the steps and get to step 9 or step 12 and poop out. It's almost better not to have started, believe it or not, than to stall out somewhere in the steps. Stalling out somewhere in the steps, it's bad karma. You know, you end up paying for that in a great way, usually, especially if you're an alcoholic.
David Parma, great for recovered alcoholic.
Amen.
So one of the things that we like to do, we've been doing word by word, line by line, journeys through the book, and one of the things that stands out for me is even though Bill is talking, giving his a presentation of what his life was like and what happened, you know, it's important for me to remember where he's coming from. The World War II has not happened yet. Prohibition is just over, and he's describing the great thing that bound him with his other fellows, which was World War I and the Great Depression, which he'll talk about a little bit later on. But one of the things that stands out for me in the part that Chris read was when he talks about the experience of Winchester Cathedral. Bill being, and he'll talk about this, a reasonable man for the church, a man who was never quite sure about his relationship with God. But he talks about, and he'll talk about Winchester Cathedral 3 times. Here he says, much moved. Right? But he doesn't explain to us, he doesn't give us an idea of what has happened to him when wandering through Winchester Cathedral. And I had the great gift of having gone to the UK a year ago this past July and hooking up with some people in CA there, and they took me to Winchester Cathedral. And I saw the headstone, which is now maintained by the Grenadiers. Every couple years they come and polish it up and maybe, you know, re-chisel a couple of words. But you can see the actual headstone. It's right in front of the cathedral. But when you walk through Winchester Cathedral, you can understand on a guttural level what Bill was talking about. It's such a majestic place. And it's a place where, you know, I realize that people have spent time, you know, making a connection to God, even though that may not be, you know, the church of my choice or anything along those lines. I understand how he may have felt going into war. And I always envisioned myself a great man as I was drinking and smoking hash in the garage. And, you know, I thought for years I was destined for great things. And here's a guy who has that opportunity to land on a foreign shore, you know, after much applause and being sent overseas. You know, he feels as though he's going to do a great thing. And I understand that, even though I never got out of the garage, you know. I mean, I understand that feeling. I took a night law course and obtained employment as an investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but soon became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that the men of genius conceive their best projects. That's what you tell Andrea? Genius conceive their best projects when drunk. That the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. Can anybody relate to that? Did you ever really think quite highly of your thought process? When sitting on the bar stool and telling the guy next to you just what you were going to do tomorrow, right?
Is this Man, the stuff I'm that you, good.
Yeah. Yeah! If they would just let me be in control of this country, everything would be fine. And I know that feeling. I, you know, the drive for success was a replace in my life for know, I had this soul sickness, which is what I believe alcoholism is in my life, and I needed to try to fill that with something, and money seemed an attainable project, right? Success seemed an attainable, I could get there somehow, whether it was when I was drinking and breaking the law, or whether it was when I was newly sober and trying to get a job that would somehow give me something that would fix me. Right, I thought money would fix me. I thought some level, if I had a couple of letters after my name, I'd be better. Something would be better. You know, the interesting thing about Bill is he actually passed the bar, but failed to pick up his degree. Anybody relate to that? Anybody ever do that? Get all the way to the end and go, ah, screw it. I don't need it. By the time I had completed the course, I knew that law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. He was enamored by this stuff. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, the combination thereof, I commenced to forge the weapon that would one day turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to the ribbons. And the weapon he's forging is a set of his character defects and the things that drove him, that separated him from God. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000 and went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and managers, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance, lack of knowledge of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. He won't give us those reasons, but we'll learn about those in a little while. Bill could not get anybody to believe in him, an attorney who didn't pick his degree up, so he hopped in a motorcycle with Lois in the sidecar and drove around the north, the Atlantic coast, up and down the coast, and would go to bars, meet the workers in factories, and find out what was really going on in a company, and then he would write a report, right, that he would send back to his friends in Wall Street, and he started to get a really good insight into what was happening in the nation's industrial saw a lot of the industrial belt was kind of on the East Coast at that point. He heard about the television before most people knew about it. He heard about these things and would report that it didn't become a popular item that you could buy for many years, but he heard about all these things and he'd write good reports because he would get people drunk and sit next to them and ply them for information, which still goes on in Wall Street today, in case you're wondering. We gave up our... Well, they do other things, too. We gave up our positions and off we rode on a motorcycle, the sidecar stuffed with 10 blankets, change of clothes, and 3 huge volumes of financial reference service. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had some success in speculation, so we had a little money, but we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. At the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me in a position there and the use of a large expense account. This is exactly what he's shooting for, right? Being important. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. Two things that I thought were massively important. I had arrived. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important, exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair-weather friends. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. There were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity, no real, there's a qualifier, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, I couldn't get it up, kept me out of those scrapes. So I remember that. I remember that it became...
That was in the original manuscript.
Yeah. That was on the previous version. I remember how I justified all the drinking I did because, well, now I'm hanging out and doing this. I got to be with those guys because those guys are happening. As I was working my way down the friendship groups. You know how you went from the people who had jobs to the people who had nicknames and no jobs, right? I worked my way down and thought that I had to drink with them, right? And when they pissed me off, well, the hell with them. I'll be fine all alone. Right? I start to separate myself from God first, and I start to separate myself from my fellow man. Because they're inconvenient to my delusion. And my delusion has me drinking. And it's happening to Bill in the middle of a pile of money and one of the greatest stock market booms this country has ever seen, the roaring 20s.
Right there. In 1929, I contracted golf fever. We went at once to the country, my wife to applaud, while I started out to overtake Walter Hagen. He was the Tiger Woods of his time. Liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. It was fun to carome around the exclusive course, which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I acquired the impeccable coat of tan one sees upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. You can see the ego involved there. I mean, I can totally relate to the ego. You know, I might not have been much, but I was all I thought about. And if I had a little bit of success in my life, man, I made a whole lot out of it. You know. Abruptly, in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. You know, why this hurt so many people is people would buy stock on option. That's the right
and margin.
And margin. And what you would do is you could buy $100 worth of stock with $10 down. And if that stock went up, you could just cash it out and walk away with your profit. But if the stock went down, now you owed money. So a lot of people were making millions of dollars, you know, just buying stuff on margin. And so if there's a big turnaround, man, you're in big trouble. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of the tape, which bore the inscription PKF 32. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were many of my friends. The papers reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. That's how he did it. Yeah. Yeah. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. I don't know about anybody else, but this would be me. You know, I would call in sick one morning because I'd be hungover, you know. And the boss would call up and give me a hard time. Hey, it's the third time this week or, you know, whatever. And I would feel terrible and I'd think, oh, my God, he's going to fire me. But I'd start drinking and, you know, about three or four drinks into it, I'm like, you know, he's an asshole, this guy. You know, I'm going to call him up and he, you know, what would he be without me? I mean, you know, it would be this complete shift in perception. So I totally relate to Bill. You know, I lost a couple of million. So what? You know, with the bottle of gin down him. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. He had plenty of money left and thought I had better go to Canada. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time, we stayed broke. Basically, what had happened was the guy knew that Bill was an alcoholic. The guy knew that he drank a bit too much. So he said, look, Bill, I'll give you this good job. I'll give you this great apartment. I'll pay you a ton of money. All you have to do is promise not to get drunk and embarrass me. And Bill's like, I promise, no problem. And he was crap hammered like within a month. Yeah. And so the guy ended up firing him. We went to live with my wife's parents. I found a job, then lost it as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Is that beautiful? You guys in a, and how do you lose a job because you get in a brawl with a taxi driver? There's got to be a lot more to the story. Everybody gets in brawls with taxi drivers, but not everybody loses their job. It must have been like right in front of the work or something.
Yeah, hell, that?
Unbelievable. Mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. He did. He became pathetic. He would drink bathtub gin, which was grain alcohol, distilled water, and a little bit of what's the name of that stuff that they put in to make gin?
It's like turpentine, right? I can't remember.
It comes from a bush,
from pine, right?
Yeah, it's like pine, but what? Juniper. You'd crush up some juniper stuff in. And so that's how you'd make your gin, because you could still buy the grain alcohol. You couldn't buy booze because it was illegal at that time. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places. And I can relate to this, too. I became an unwelcome attender at bars in my last drinking days. Because, you know, I knew better than to go to a bar until I was in a blackout. You know, then I'd stumble into some bar. It was always bad news. So, you know, I know how he felt. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often 3, got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s, and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin, followed by a half dozen bottles of beer, would be required if I was to eat any breakfast. You know, toward the end of my drinking, I wasn't putting a lot of food calories down either. A lot of times, what I would do is I'd get really drunk, and then I'd go downstairs and I'd cook up a pound of bacon, you know, with like 4 slices of white bread, and I'd have dinner. I mean, it was just terrible. I don't know how I'm still alive.
What's changed?
Right. I put butter on it now. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. See, his wife's brother, I think, was Leonard Strong or something. Yeah. Anyway, this guy was a doctor, and he was able to get Bill into Towns Hospital for like the cut rate. So Bill would go off to get detoxed every once in a while. And Towns was a very expensive hospital. We talked about Towns Hospital a little bit last week. So off Bill would go. Gradually, things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at the low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and that chance vanished. I woke up. This had to be stopped. Here, think about this for a bad first step understanding. I saw that I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. How many of us thought that all we would really need to do was not want to drink enough and everything would be fine? I did. I went to treatment thinking that. I was in early AA thinking that. Well, you know, I thought I went to AA because it was like some kind of spiritual pep rally. You know, we'd go in, yay, we don't drink today. And we'd re-remind each other that we shouldn't drink. That's what I thought AA was all about. Well, he's talking about having an absolutely crystal clear understanding that he cannot drink anymore. It is absolutely killing him, and he's making decisions, very, very strong decisions, to stop drinking.
Doesn't he have pledges in his Bible?
There's pledges in the Bible. You know, this time I really mean it.
If you go to Stepping Stones, I believe, right, there's a Bible up there. It's Bill Wilson. And doesn't he sign in there at least once, if not a couple of times?
Today, in fact, is the last day of his last promise.
Today is the last day of his last promise in the Bible.
September, yeah.
I mean, listen, if you're going to pledge in a Bible, you usually mean it, you know? You know, because there could be consequences, you know, for being duplicitous. Now, it says, before then, I'd written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business. And so I did. I mean, he was done. He had made a decision to stop drinking. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. What the hell's that all about? There had been no fight. How can there be no fight? He made it put a pledge in the Bible. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Now, I've experienced this. This is what the first step is basically alluding to when it says we need to admit to powerlessness. Because I'll tell you what, if there's anything we can do to prevent alcohol from going into our body, we're not powerless. All we need to do is do whatever that is, and we'll be fine. The problem is that we're powerless. we have to get in touch with a power greater than ourselves that prevents us from drinking, because we can't do it. We have what's known as an obsession in the mind. We talked about that last week. We were going over the doctor's opinion. It doesn't matter how much you don't want to drink. It doesn't matter. If you're an alcoholic, you're going to drink without a vital spiritual experience. That's what alcoholism is. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day, I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it had happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time. But I might as well get good and drunk now. And I did. Now, I swear to God, this happened to me. I think I talked about this last week. You know, I was on my way to an AA meeting. And I signed myself into a rehab. I signed myself into aftercare. And I started going to horrible closed-minded discussion meetings. And I did it all because I really wanted to stop drinking. I was so concerned about my drinking. And on the way to an AA meeting, the thought crossed my mind that I should buy a gallon of vodka and drink it, because it'll help improve my sobriety. And I did that. I drank a gallon of vodka to improve my sobriety. It sounds insane. Unless you're alcoholic, you'll know what I mean. How many times have we promised we're done? We're good. This is it. It's never, honey, it's never going to happen again. Your Honor, I swear this is never going to happen. How many times have we done that? And what's happened is we've ended up drunk again. Listen, don't kid yourself. It's not you changing your mind. You don't change your mind to do something insane. That's insanity. That's not changing your mind. Like, well, I decided that after 14 years in AA, I could have a drink. Okay, that makes a whole lot of sense.
Mm.
That's a big piece of sanity right there. I would do the same thing after 14 years of going to AA meetings to pick up a drink. And we kid ourselves. We believe we had something to do with that. We even sometimes believe that we were there when the relapse happened. Powerlessness is powerlessness. If the power is not working in us and through us, the power greater than ourselves, we don't stand a chance. Alcohol goes in our body. Or we kill ourselves, or we go insane. That's what happens to alcoholics. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. You know why there was a sense of impending calamity? His calamity was impending for him. I hardly dared cross the street, lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck. He's going through the DTs, folks, and he doesn't really know what that is. For it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My wreathing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that. Two bottles and oblivion. The last couple of years of my drinking, that's what I drank for. I didn't drink to, bring the party back. I drank because it was intolerable being existing as me. I was so emotionally and mentally in agony. The bondage of self, they talk about, that I would drink as much alcohol as I could just to shut my head off, just to disappear. Oblivion was what I was drinking for. So I understand what Bill is saying here. The mind and the body are marvelous mechanisms, for I endured this agony for two more years. Think about it. He's drinking 2 to 3 bottles of gin every day. That is absolutely poisoning a body with alcohol. It's absolutely amazing that our bodies can tolerate what we do to it with this kind of drinking. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. What I would do is I had a 38 caliber handgun. It's not something I should have had, but I had it, and it was loaded, and I would put it up to my head, you know, and I would just, you know, I never had the courage to pull the trigger. I kept thinking about my daughter. You know, did I want my daughter to have to live with the fact that her father put a bullet through his head when she was 6 years old? I just couldn't, you know, the grace of God, whatever. I just couldn't do it. But I understand what Bill is talking about. There were flights from city to country and back, and my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window. What he's saying here is he's afraid that he will freak out in the middle of these DTs and run and jump through his window. He was like on the sixth floor of some brownstone or something. Sash and all, somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor lest I suddenly leap. Now imagine this. He lives in an apartment building. Oh, Bill, where are you taking your mattress? No, down the lobby. I'm sleeping in the lobby, man. I'm going to jump out the window. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. You bet he did. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. I know that one too. Oh my God. Anybody in here a gin and sedative drinker? Holy cow. I went to the doctor one time because I was experiencing DTs and I didn't really know what they were. Nobody gave me an education in alcoholism before I became an alcoholic. So what it was I was going into DTs. I was like shaking and my eyes were yellow and I was nervous. And I went to the doctor once. I said, Doc, man, I'm anxious. I'm nervous. I'm always feeling stress. I'm tired. Loud noises. And he goes, hold on a minute. And he takes his stethoscope and he puts it against my heart. And I'm in the middle of DTs, right? My heart's going, like, he goes, whoa. He goes, it sounds like you have a protracted mitral valve, and I bet it's being brought on by anxiety. And I'm like, sounds good. You know, you got anything for that? You know, and he goes, yeah, I got this new drug on the market. It's called Xanax. I go, what kind of milligram inches you got those in, Doc? I'm going to need the big ones. And he gave me the big ones. And I got to tell you, within a month, I wasn't counting them anymore. I was weighing them in my hand. I was pouring out, it feels like enough, and then washing them down with vodka or bourbon. I mean, the biggest letters on these pill bottles are no alcohol. No alcohol doesn't even register for an alcoholic. We're the type of people, we've got our third DWI, and we say, I've got to stop driving. You know what I mean? We're just not the type of people who think about stopping drinking. It just, until we've had our last drink, man, forget about it. You can't pull us away with a Komatsu tractor. So you know, I mean, listen, that's exactly how crazy I was. How crazy I was. So I was doing these Xanax and drinking. I didn't know a sober moment for like 6 months because those things noodle you. If you do a handful of Xanax with vodka, you're not only noodled then, you're noodled the next day. You can bend like Gumby on those things. I've got to tell you. And I remember walking in and my boss seeing me and he's looking at me and he goes, God damn it! What the hell's wrong with you? You know, I'm like, nothing. What do you mean? You know, I put my shirt on backwards that morning or something. Oh, it was crazy. Just crazy.
My brother-in-law was a physician, and through his kindness, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. This is Towns Hospital. Under the so-called Belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Now, Belladonna is a poison, right? It's a raspy weed that you may find in your backyard if you live in the right place. If you're lucky. If you want to test it, you tried that out, didn't you, in high school?
Right. It made a bunch of us go partially blind. Like, and I remember we all came in the next day. Like, hey man, did you go blind too? Oh, it was crazy.
And that was the treatment. Yeah, that was the upside to alcoholism.
You couldn't find the liquor store. That was the treatment. Liquor store,
yeah. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill bodily and mentally. So he's going to introduce to us when he gets introduced to the idea that this is not just this failure that I have. I had managed a lot of things fairly well in my life, even up until the end. You know, I never got killed by the people who I knew, which were nice because, you know, I was a full-time criminal. And that was one of the requirements, was that if you weren't acting right, they would kill you. And I was able to kind of keep certain things together. But in those last 2 years, the wheels had really come off. You know, I even had a heroin dealer say, "I don't want to work with you anymore. You know, you're just not up to my character. You know, you're just not up to snuff. You know, look at you, you're falling apart." I mean, that's pretty bad. You know, but I was a lone wolf. I was okay at that point. And you know, the problem is those last 2 years were such a horror show, and it became the most natural and normal life that I had ever led. Right. Doesn't the alcoholic life become the most natural thing that we do? Mm-hmm. And it's just, what do you mean you're arresting me because I was pissing in the middle of the street? Doesn't everybody do that? You know? What do you mean because I parked the car on the lawn? You know, you're upset, you know? What do you mean? These are the things that I do every day, and they just are what I have to do to keep going. And then I get a break. And then I get introduced to the idea that it's just not my failure to manage and control my drinking. It's just not a failure of you people to realize it, right? But obviously, it starts to be presented to me that it has something to do beyond my control. My ability to control it is out of my hands, because if it was in my hands, I wouldn't do those things, right? I don't do those things over strawberries, right? I don't do those things over shellfish. I don't do those things over anything else in my life. But when it comes to alcohol, I'll do all those things. So he's getting introduced to the concept that it's a phenomenon of craving and a mental obsession. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it's often remains strong in other respects. Okay, that's my experience. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was finally explained. Right, understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. I have new knowledge. It'll be okay. I'll use this great mind that God gave me to be fine. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high, which is a phrase that means things were good.
That you're hanging geese.
Yeah, or that you're hanging geese. That's right. Which probably wasn't happening a lot in Brooklyn, right? I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. Now, a wet brain, by the way, has nothing to do with water. Right? A wet brain is when I have desiccated my brain, when I have removed the fluid that normally keeps my brain healthy by replacing it with a solvent, alcohol. And those cells can't live anymore because the water has been displaced by alcohol. If I drink enough alcohol, it will replace the water in my body in certain places, and eventually things start to die, like the liver and the brain. Really kind of sad when you think about it. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities and my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining that endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much unhappiness after all, what I would not give to make amends. But that was over now. No words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. Trembly, I stepped from the hospital, broken man. Fear sobered me a bit. Then came the insidious sanity of that first drink. And on Armistice Day, 1934, I was off again. Now, this is an interesting story about Bill. Bill had been keeping it together somewhat coming out of Towns Hospital. And he just wanted to go play a little golf. And, you know, Lois was happy to see him leave the house. So off he went with his clubs, and he got on a bus, and he's traveling out to, I think it was Staten Island. There's a golf course in Staten Island. And the bus driver runs into a cab. So the bus has to stop and wait for a replacement bus. And he strikes up a friendship with the guy next to him in the bus who happens to be going to the same country club as him. He said, okay, great. So off they go to the country club, now a little delayed, so they can't get out for the first round in the morning, but they get there just in time for lunch. And he sits down. Now, he has spent the last hour and a half telling this guy all about his alcoholism. He is sharing with this fellow just how horrendous his life has become, how he's playing golf while his wife is working in Bambergers, right? And off he is sitting in this country club on Armistice Day, and this fellow is really listened to his story and feels this great compassion for him, knowing he's a war veteran and everything. He goes, "Can I buy you lunch, you know, before we go out?" And the guy goes, "Yeah." Bill goes, "Yeah, sure." They bring him a little lunch at the bar. They're finishing their lunch, and the bartender walks over and goes, "Here's two drinks for the veterans on Armistice Day." Armistice Day is the Veterans Day. Bill picks up his drink and puts it back. And the guy is aghast. He is absolutely shocked. He is staring at Bill, who has just sat there and spent an hour and a half talking about how alcohol was destroying his life. And he says to Bill, he goes, "You just had a drink. You must be insane." And Bill goes, "I guess I am." Lois would not see him until about 1 o'clock in the morning that day, and she would find him crumpled in the foyer of their brownstone with his club is like dangling over the railing, and him just curled up in a ball. He couldn't quite get the key in the lock. Remember those days when you couldn't get the key in the lock? Someone kept moving the lock? "I can't get the key in the lock, Lois. Help me."
Or you got the wrong apartment.
Yeah. I was off again. Everyone becomes resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. Remember, there is no solution to alcoholism in this year, 1934. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. And that's a promise. Near the end of that bleak November, now here's a very important part of this book, I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected that there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. Do you remember when you had a stash that would just keep you long enough till you thought you could pass out? Do you remember when you had just enough to make it to be okay? Right? I remember those moments. The first 7 minutes, right, after I started drinking, when everything seemed okay, I got 7 minutes out of 4 days. That was usually pretty good. I'd go with that ratio. Right? Or the last period where I knew that I was able to make it to when I would pass out. Carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. Thank God. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of the bed. I would need it before daylight. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. In the original manuscript, this is underlined. He was sober. This is, bless you. That is Ebbie Thatcher, his drinking buddy. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he'd been committed for alcoholic insanity. Now, the story with Ebbie is that Ebbie was on his way to being committed for alcoholic insanity. Ebbie was a drinking partner from a friend of Bill's up in Vermont, and he had been out drinking one night, and he was known to the local police for his ability to drink and drive. And Ebbie was out drinking that night, and he missed a turn and drove into somebody's living room. And the woman was sitting on the couch, and she was surprised, right? There's now a car in her living room, right? That was unusual for that time of night. And Ebbie got out of the car and turned to her and says, "Ma'am, I'll have a cup of coffee with two sugars," right? But he ended up before a judge, in about a month and a half. They arrested him. They knew him. You're not going anywhere. It's a town of like 1,100. They all know you. And Abe shows up before the judge to get sentenced for this, right? And who shows up at Roland Hazard and?
Roland Hazard and Sebra Graves?
Yes, right. Yeah. Now, here's the interesting thing. I've personally never shown up before a judge and taken ownership of another person. But Roland Hazard and this fellow show up, and they say, you know what? If you don't commit him, if you don't put him away, we'll take responsibility for him. Now, why does that mean anything? Well, there's two reasons. One is that Roland Hazard came from a wealthy industrial family in the Northeast and was well-known in the town because they would summer in Vermont. Right? They knew that they were a family of means and that they could take care of Ebbie if they took ownership of him. They also knew that Roland was a good member of the Oxford Group. Right? And there's a second reason. The judge was a cousin of Roland.
That helped.
So that helped a lot. So Roland brings Ebbie Thatcher into the Oxford Group, who basically has trust God, clean house, and help others. That's their basic motto, right? And they get Ebbie cleaned up, and he gets down with the Oxford Group, and he gets wired. And his first job after getting wired is to go out and help another alcoholic. Who does he think of? Bill Wilson. Ebbie's sober 6 weeks when he shows up at Bill's house. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he'd been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. Of course he would have dinner, and then I could drink openly with him, an old drinking buddy. I'm mindful of his welfare, because I really don't care about you. I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was the time we chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this drear desert of the futility. The very thing, an oasis. Right? Drinkers are like that. The door opened and he stood there, fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? Oh my God, I remember that. I remembered seeing I remember seeing people who looked better. I didn't feel that way when I saw him, right? I had no idea how you got there. And it was odd. I remember going to the Lower East Side, and you could always tell who was down there for the reason you were down there, because they looked, shallow and yellow and scared and purposeful, right? Not like your typical AA meeting, right? And when I see that person who's come alive, you know it. You can see it in their eyes. They have a different demeanor about them. And Bill sees this in Ebbie, right? I pushed a drink across the table. Why wait, right? He refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had got into the fellow. He wasn't himself. Come, what's all this about? I queried. He looked straight at me. Simply but smilingly, he said, I've got religion. I don't know, but I would have left even if it was my apartment at that point. I would not have hung around. I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic.
I was aghast.
Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I can understand that. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right, but bless his heart. Let him rant. Besides, my gym would last longer than his preaching. But he did no ranting. How cool is this, right? In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. So the program of action is not crazy, is it? We don't need to crawl on our knees 11,000 miles to go place a flower at a shrine, is it? It's something practical. I don't need to give my firstborn. You know, I don't need to get a tattoo of Chris on my left shoulder to match my right shoulder. You know, it's a practical program. What? It's a practical program of action, right? It's simple. I can do this. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. He had come to pass his experience along to me if I cared to have it. I was shocked, but interested. Right? I get a speck of hope, a speck of light in this dreary, horrific place that I'm at, where tomorrow cannot be better than today, where I am mired in hopelessness, where there is just absolutely my first choice other than drinking is to stand in front of that medicine cabinet and pull that poison out, or to not move my bed to the lower floor, but to jump. Right? Those are the two choices I'm left with at the end. He talked for hours. He had come to pass his experience along to me. If I cared to have it, I was shocked, but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. He talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat.
on Still Sundays, way over there on the hillside. There was that proffered temperance pledge I never signed. My grandfather, good-natured contempt of some church folk and their doings. His insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. Right? I don't like being directed. His fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died, these recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard. So they touched Bill in a certain way. Now we're going to go back to Winchester Cathedral. That wartime day in old Winchester Cathedral came back. Came back again. I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had offered to ponder these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are. For that means a blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlie all. How could there be so much of precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe, and this is capitalized, right? Meaning he's talking about God, who knew neither time nor limitation, but that was as far as I had gone. I will not go down that path, because what happens is when I start to have an understanding of what a power greater than myself looks like, it conflicts with the delusion that I built up that keeps me drinking. And I will not. My delusion will not allow anything to interfere with it. It will find a way to make fun of you if you're a religious person or if you're a particular faith. It'll find a way of making you different from me. It'll have me sitting in a meeting and telling me that the story you're telling is different than mine. It'll have me sitting in a meeting saying the experience you had is not mine. It'll do whatever it can to survive. It doesn't want to be extinguished. And it is what drove me for many years, staying separate from you. With ministers in the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, this is Bill's description of what they're telling him, I became irritated, my mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ I can see the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him. His moral teaching, most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded.
Okay.
The rest I disregarded.
Okay. Just a quick story, and then we're gonna open it up. What was going on with Bill at this period of time was he was. This isn't in his story, but it's in what happened with him. He didn't sober up the day Ebby came by and did the 12-step work. It took a number of more months. But what he did do is he got interested in the Oxford group. And Ebby was able to come over to his house and grab him and take him to Oxford group meetings. And he was going there blasted out of his mind. He would be as drunk as possible. And there was this one time where he was thrown out of the church because while somebody was up there witnessing, during the Oxford group meetings, you know, people would get up and witness. As they do sometimes today in some of the evangelical churches. They'll get up and they'll tell the story about how they came to believe in or turn their will and their life over to Jesus. And so Bill, like drunk and like moves up there and pushes the guy aside and starts witnessing. And, you know, they get him with the hook and they drag him out. And it's just a debacle. So he was being exposed to this. And you know, that's part of his story. And listen, it's so like what we alcoholics can do. I mean, when we're in blackouts or when we're really drunk or whatever, sometimes we get on a mission and it's bad. And sometimes we don't sober up right away when we're exposed to the solution. That's also typical of alcoholics. My first AA meeting was in 1983, and I went there pretty drunk because I thought that would be appropriate. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcohol's in the name, Dave. I cannot drink there. You know what I mean? So I had no idea what AA was like. So I went up there really drunk. And, you know, people were like trying to talk to me after the meeting. I now understand why. You know, I'm a new guy, right? So one guy comes up to me and starts saying, yeah, I sponsor people. He's like hinting that I should ask him to sponsor me. And I didn't know what that meant. All right? I hadn't been exposed to AA at all. And I'm thinking, you know, I used to race motorcycles, and a sponsor would give you gas money, you know, to get to the race if you wore his shirt. So I'm thinking, I ain't going to wear this guy's shirt. I don't need gas money. I'm not going to be driving until there's Jetson mobiles because I got a third DUI. And I'm wondering why this guy's bothering me. It was just, it was bad. The worst I heard, though, my sponsor told me this story. My first sponsor, Fish Food Phil. Rarely is there somebody in a meeting who remembers Phil W., my first sponsor, but Patty is in the meeting tonight, and she goes way back with me to the early groups that I was sober at. And Phil told me the story. He was in a Morristown St. Pete's meeting. And it was like a Wednesday night meeting, and they had a big room, bigger than this, with the tables set up in a square, and people would sit around the table, and it was a discussion meeting. And during the meeting, this one guy was raising his hand. Finally, they call on him. And he goes, yeah, you know, I need to share. I really need to share something. I got something important to share. And they're all like, okay, fine. He goes, well, to be able to share it, I got to stand up on the table. And they're all like, uh-oh. The guy gets up on the table, turns around, and drops drawers. Okay, right in the AA meeting. Can you imagine? I'm thinking. Wouldn't that be perfect? You know, to do that, like if you're in your AA meeting and you come to the next morning, and the people are laughing at you, saying, "Dude, man, you know, at the gratitude meeting last night, you dropped drawers." You know, and I just can imagine. But this is the kind of stuff that that Bill Wilson was doing. Anyway, yeah. We should probably open it up.
Yeah, we probably should.
All right. So now is when you can make.